I'm Andrew Saul, Commissioner of Social Security. Beware of telephone scammers pretending to be government employees. Real Social Security employees will never threaten you. Callers threatening you with arrest or other legal action and demanding money are not from us. If you receive a call like this, hang up, do not provide them with any form of payment or information. Report the call at oig.ssa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, a little show called Viva La Mock, or it's called Viva La Mock, or just Viva La Mock. Either way, anyway, hey, I'm the Mockster. I'm your host for at least the next hour. I can't make any guarantees beyond that. My goal is to be here at least for the hour, playing you some songs. Before I get into more songs, I want to remind you that Spack Brothers Pizza joins you in supporting WRCT. Now, Spack Brothers Pizza, well, they offer pizza. They also have hoagies, and they have wings, and they specialize in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Now, Spack Brothers does not use any refined sugars in their sauce or any unbleached flour in their dough. And they're committed to safety during this ongoing pandemic by providing online ordering and payments, as well as a contact-free pickup. You can actually learn more online by going to SPACbrothers.com, or you can call them up at 412-362-SPAC. Again, that's 412-362-SPAK, SPAKbrothers.com, or 412-362-7725. And if you need to stop by when you pick it up, they are located at 5107 Penn Avenue in the Garfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Hey, and also, while I'm just talking about stuff, don't forget, you can come fall in the trap door because there are monsters underneath and listen to punk, folk, hardcore, and more with DJ Sideways on Trap Door at 10 p.m. on Tuesdays right here on WRCT. If you got a suggestion for a song, send me an email at wrctrequest@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From High
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT.
88.3 FM.
FM.
A radio.
So many of you will remember that I've been giving good news about declining COVID cases on the show in the United States, dating back to really the first few days of September. I've also been saying since late October that decline is starting to slow down. And then we got to, well, the cases are now flat. They're no longer declining. We don't know if this is an inflection point and cases will start going back up, or if they'll stay flat, or if they'll continue on down. We don't know what will happen heading into winter. We now have a modest but clear trend, which is that cases in the United States are going back up. And in fact, they've been on the upswing since roughly Halloween, so close to a couple of weeks. And cases are now up in the United States, just shy of about 10% per day. We had gotten down to 71,000 cases a day, which is crazy to think that, wow, we had a huge decline down to 71,000 cases a day. That is now back up to 77,000 cases a day. And this is really, really not good. Now, if we were at the point where cases no longer meant deaths, either because enough vaccination has taken place where most folks are protected against serious illness and death, or because of a less deadly strain that has evolved, this wouldn't be as bad. But those things haven't happened yet. And so far, deaths have been following cases by about 3 to 4 weeks. And just as we saw cases stop their decline 3 to 4 weeks ago, deaths are now flat. Deaths are no longer declining. They're stuck at about 1,100 COVID deaths per day in the United States. So there is every possibility that we are at the beginning of a new spike and a potentially very ugly winter. Now, maybe not. Maybe not. We don't really know yet, but the case increase has started and the death decline has stopped. Now, often, as we've seen throughout the pandemic, what happens in the United States follows what happens in other parts of the world. Part of the reason for that is that many of the spikes are caused by variants, which we first observe in other parts of the world, like Europe. So far, the global numbers are not looking particularly auspicious for the United States over the next 3 months. Cases around the world are up even more than in the United States. Globally, cases had bottomed back. They'd bottomed out at 403,000 cases a day. Globally, cases are now up to 472,000 cases a day. So while in the U.S. cases are up 9 or 10%, globally cases are up about 17%. That's not a great signal for what is to come here. As far as global deaths, those are slightly up. Global deaths had bottomed out around 6,600 a day. Deaths are now back up to 7,100 a day around the world. That's an increase of about 6 or 7%. So if there is any good news to point to, and even this, you'll see why it's not even that great, we can point to, hey, vaccinations every day are now climbing in the United States. They're not incredible numbers. Looking at the graph on the screen, if you're watching today, you might see that daily vaccinations really bottomed out in mid-July. And then as Delta surged and discussion of Delta surged, vaccinations also started to increase. In late July, we were down to about 550,000 doses a day. That has climbed and climbed, almost tripling. And we're now doing, over the last week, about 1.3 million doses per day. Unfortunately, and this is just horrible, the not so good thing is that the increased doses per day are significantly driven by people who already have two doses getting a third dose. So you're not vaccinating that many new people. If you ask the question, how many new people are getting vaccinated each day? It might only be a couple hundred thousand to maybe 300,000. Sadly, I mean, it's good that people are getting third doses and more protection, but a huge portion of the daily doses today are people getting a third dose. Good for those people, not so good for the population at large. Now that 5 to 11-year-olds can start to get vaccinated in the U.S., we do expect the number of kids with one dose in that age group to be at roughly 1 million right now. About 1 million kids have already gotten vaccinated. That's good. But the misinformation continues to kill people. We have a report from Colorado, from CBS Denver, which says that according to a Colorado ICU nurse, there are many COVID patients. They're in the ICU with COVID. They don't believe the virus is real. They believe the hospital made them sick. And in some cases, they call the nurses murderers. So that's very bad. We will see what things look like by Thanksgiving. I've started to get questions from some of you about what is my Thanksgiving plan from the standpoint of medical, from the standpoint of COVID. I'm going to be doing a testing Thanksgiving. So it's going to be maybe outdoor, maybe indoor, depending on the weather. Everybody will be tested. And I've interviewed, everybody will be vaccinated and tested. When we interviewed Vincent Racaniello from Columbia University, and I said to him, sir, is this foolproof? If people get a test right as they're going in, is there any way you might be incubating and contagious but negative? And he basically said, if you're using the test for a few hour gathering, it's essentially foolproof in the sense that, this was what he said, if you are incubating the virus and you don't yet have symptoms and you test negative, you're almost certainly not contagious for the next few hours. So what you wouldn't want to do because of this possibility that you've been infected, you're incubating, but you don't yet test positive. Don't use a test as justification to hang out for a week without doing any more testing, because then you might turn positive and turn contagious. But if you're doing a few hour gathering, Vincent Racaniello was confident that if everybody has a negative test, everybody's going to be not contagious, at least for a few hours. So that's my plan for Thanksgiving. I'm curious to hear about yours. You know, I have not spoken much recently on the podcast and the broadcast because about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, because we've been covering essentially the full trial every day on Facebook and YouTube, not on Twitch because we're banned from Twitch for 30 days. So I've just been getting so much of it, I haven't commented. But I do want to talk about it a little bit today. Over the last 24 hours, the Kyle Rittenhouse case in Kenosha, Wisconsin, it's the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, who is accused of when he was 17 last year, homicide against two individuals that he killed, as well as miscellaneous other charges related to guns and other things. This is a trial where the defense has now taken over. The defense called Kyle Rittenhouse to the stand as a witness, and the prosecution was able to cross-examine Kyle Rittenhouse yesterday. This has now led to a call for a mistrial by the defense. So let's look at one article about this, and then we're going to look at a video because the judge flipped out yesterday. This is getting a lot of attention because it has become quite wacky. The Kyle Rittenhouse case is now in jeopardy as lawyers seek a mistrial. Trial judge accuses prosecutor of improper line of questioning. What has taken place is that the defense has asked for a mistrial on two bases. The first is that at the beginning of his cross-examination of Kyle Rittenhouse, the prosecutor sought to ask Kyle Rittenhouse about not making a comprehensive public statement about what he believes happened. The judge felt that this was trying to use Rittenhouse's silence against him, which would be a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Okay, that's one basis on which the defense wants a mistrial. The other basis on the on which the defense wants a mistrial is that they say the prosecutor questioned Rittenhouse about things which the judge had already said should not be brought up. This is a basic summary of the reasoning for the defense's request for a mistrial. The judge is considering that request. The defense wants a mistrial with prejudice, meaning that that's it, that the case can't be restarted. A new case can't be restarted against Kyle Rittenhouse. That would be wild if that took place. I also want to play for you video when this was being discussed of the judge sort of flipping out on the prosecutor. Take a look at this.
In the questions, I ask the court to strongly admonish him. And the next time it happens, I'll be asking for a mistrial with prejudice. He's an experienced attorney and he knows better.
Mr. Finger?
First of all, Your Honor, this was the subject of a motion. I'm well aware of that. And the court left the door open.
For me, not for you.
Well, my understanding of
you should have come and asked for reconsideration. You did on the one motion, and in fact, I granted your motion for reconsideration.
That was not our motion.
I granted.
We did not move to reconsider.
That was their motion.
We have not filed any motions to reconsider in this case.
That was their motion for reconsideration, which I denied. But I said I denied it. Or I indicated a bias towards denial is what I did. Held it open with a bias towards denial. Why would you think that that made it okay for you without any advance notice to bring this matter before the jury? I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that.
So as many have noticed, the judge seems to only bring this level of energy against the prosecution. There have been a whole bunch of questions raised about this judge. And listen, if the judge is biased, there's going to be the possibility of an appeal in theory, although prosecution appeals and jury verdicts are very, very tough. I want to just kind of give my general take on this case at this point in time, because I'm getting a lot of emails from people saying, David, this is obviously self-defense. David, even TYT now says it was self-defense. I don't know what TYT has said, to be clear. I'm just saying people are telling me that that's what TYT has said. Let me make my position on this case very, very clear. I believe that Kyle Rittenhouse's self-defense from a legal perspective is going to be valid enough, plausible enough in the immediate situation in which he shot the two people that he killed, that he will be found not guilty. I believe that it is a plausible, I believe it may be quite true that he feared for his life in that moment, which is what is on trial. Okay, so I'm not saying any of this, he's obviously guilty. It obviously wasn't self-defense. I think that from a legal standpoint, self-defense is going to be valid enough based on the facts that not guilty will be the verdict there. I also believe that the entire context here is a disgusting context. He had no business going to Kenosha and being armed that night. the totality of the incident is nauseating. And the fact that if he's convicted, he will be considered a martyr by the right. If he is acquitted, he will be made a hero by the right for the fact that he was there with a gun defending himself. When the truth is that this case is emblematic of everything wrong with American culture around guns, masculinity, vigilante justice, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you can break down each part and say, well, OK, in general, just being a 17-year-old being familiar with guns is not inherently wrong or immoral. In theory, protecting property while holding a gun, it's not, I mean, you know, would we feel differently as a viewer emailed me if this was someone protecting a black-owned business with a gun from KKK looters or something like that? Most progressives would probably say, no, that it's okay that that's being done. And if you do this, you certainly can make the case that there's no particular one smoking gun. But this is a symptom of toxic underlying conditions, gun culture, vigilante culture, etc. And that is different than should he be found guilty. That's not a crime, what I just said. So let's not misstate each other's beliefs about this. And for the people emailing me saying, David, you're so wrong for saying that he should be found guilty. It's for the jury to decide. And I believe that the evidence for the narrow circumstances at issue in the case, self-defense is plausible and that he will be found not guilty on the homicides. That's my belief. Send me your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman. Okay, let's get into some interesting Twitter posts from this morning. Reddit posts. You can join the discussion at davidpacman.com/Reddit. More than 33,000 of our viewers and listeners are currently subscribed to Reddit. Few interesting posts that caught my eye. Homelander posted, lying about a vaccination status is way worse than kneeling for the national anthem. Let's watch all the right wingers that canceled Colin Kaepernick call what Aaron Rodgers did patriotic. Yeah, I mean, listen, if you believe the pandemic is real and you believe that vaccines are something that prevents you statistically from getting really sick or dying from the virus and all of that stuff, if you understand reality, you would have to agree with the statement that what Aaron Rodgers did, claiming to be immunized when he's not, putting teammates at risk, etc., is obviously far worse than when Colin Kaepernick kneeled during the national anthem. The problem is that many of these right wingers and Trumpians live in an alternate reality where the pandemic isn't real, or at least it's not serious, and vaccines are bad. And the worst thing you can do is something cultural like kneel during the national anthem. So you and I agree on this. But the folks that are living in this alternate reality don't. There was also an interesting post asking who's winning on the vaccine issue politically. Is it Democrats or is it Republicans? Now, the people from Reddit who voted in the poll by about a three to one, about 75-25 margin, said that Democrats are winning on the vaccine issue ideologically. The problem with this is that the winning would be not dying from the virus. And unfortunately, there are people across the political spectrum who are dying from the virus because in part of the anti-vaccine propaganda that's being spread. Now, that being said, earlier this week, we looked at the numbers. The cumulative COVID death rate in Trump counties is now about 50% higher than the cumulative COVID death rate in Biden counties. Even within the Biden counties, it would stand to reason, since the Republicans are the most unvaccinated, that even within Biden counties, it's more Republicans dying than Democrats. So it is becoming partisan. And if you consider dying from the virus losing, as increasingly Republicans are, then that is a way in which Democrats are winning on the virus, but on vaccination, rather. But we aren't going to get out of this in any serious way until more people are on board and until more people are vaccinated. And so, unfortunately, as a country, we've lost a lot. We've lost a lot. And we can point fingers accurately, as we have been doing. But what I want to get to is the end of the pandemic. And remember, the end of the pandemic is likely to be COVID becoming endemic and a certain level of cases and deaths, much like with flu, that are not going to go away at least for years, at least for years. So who's really winning? I feel like we've all lost a lot over the last year and a half of this pandemic. One other post from the subreddit. A user is asking for medical advice and says, can someone reach out to Joe Rogan and see if he would consult with me about colonoscopies? Hi, I'm 23 and highly lactose intolerant. Can someone ask Joe Rogan if it's too early to start getting colonoscopies? Is Joe taking appointments? I'd prefer his expert view on my colon health. Thanks. So obviously, this is a reference to the fact that now we've heard that NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers took medical advice from Joe Rogan, and enlightened centrist political commentator Tim Pool took COVID advice from Joe Rogan. Listen, as I've said before, I don't think there's anything wrong with talking to people you know about their experience with the disease. If you were diagnosed with a form of cancer, it would be totally reasonable to go talk to a doctor and to get a second opinion and do all of those things. And if you had a friend who had had or has that type of cancer, it's totally reasonable to go and say, hey, what were the side effects of the course of treatment you chose? How did you feel? How did this work? What was your doctor's recommendation? That makes perfect sense. But when we start taking anecdotal advice from non-medical professionals about things where we have data, things like ivermectin and others, that's when things sort of seem to go off the rails. So listen, talking to friends about their experiences with a disease or medication is totally reasonable. But the degree to which Aaron Rodgers seriously said, well, I mean, listen, I took advice from Joe Rogan on what to do, starts to get a little weird, starts to get a little cultish almost. Join the discussion at davidpakman.com/reddit. I have a story for you today that is really two stories coming together. Story one is the story of dishonest Fox News graphics and charts. Story two is about labor force conspiracy theories, which we've talked about before. And the graphic in question here is one that Fox News put up on the screen yesterday to try to make Joe Biden look bad, which simply says the American workforce, Trump peak, 164 million people working. Biden last month, only 161 million people working, making the point that there are 3.1 million fewer people in the workforce as of last month under Joe Biden than at the peak during Donald Trump's administration. Now, I hope that by now, people who have been watching the show, listening to the show for a while, know at least two reasons why this is so deceptive. But the labor force stuff is really frequently used by the right to attack Democrats. So I think it's important to talk about all of it. So first of all, without knowing anything about how the labor force participation rate or labor force participation numbers are quantified, calculated, without knowing anything at all, you should be suspicious as soon as you see the Trump peak compared with last month. This is called cherry picking of data. The data for the Trump peak is December of 2019. They picked that number instead of the number at the end of Donald Trump's presidency. Why? Well, because the labor force has grown since Donald Trump left office. If you compare the end of Trump's term to right now, you would have to say the labor force has grown under Joe Biden. So they pick December of 2019. Now, to that end, why has the labor force been all over the place? It's been because of the pandemic, and that's still not over. So even at the top level, a comparison over the last couple years of the labor force participation is of dubious value. It's a different time in American history because of the pandemic. So yes, Fox News is being really deceptive. They're cherry picking. They're leaving out information. Their viewers are mostly clueless. They see this and they say, oh my God, what a disaster Biden has been. But there's even more instructive stuff here. The labor participation rate in general isn't a good indicator of how the economy is doing. And in fact, in a good economy, the labor participation rate and the number of people out of the labor force can go down. Wait, sir, what? How is that possible? This is how it's possible. The labor force participation rate is a measure of an economy's active workforce. So it's when we talk about there's 161 million or 164 million people in the labor force, we are saying this is the sum total of all workers employed or seeking employment. Remember, the way it's measured, if you're unemployed but looking for work, you're in the labor force. If you stop looking for work, you're out of the labor force. But if you retire, you're out of the workforce. If you're 20 and in college full time, you're out of the workforce and you reduce the labor participation rate. So think about that. Really think about it. If you have a bad economy, there are people who would love to retire, but they can't afford to. So they need a job. So they get one. The labor participation rate has just gone up. But it's because the economy is bad that someone who would like to be retired has gotten a job. Okay? If the economy is bad, a college student might have to drop out of school and get a job to help their family. So the economy being bad has increased the labor participation rate by forcing a college student to go and get a job. That's not a good statistic by itself to tell us how the economy is doing or whether a president is doing a good job. If wages went up, now think about the opposite. If wages went up and the economy did well, you would see more people say, great, I can now retire. Up, labor participation rate goes down, but it's because the economy is good. One last thing, and this is like a systemic thing about these numbers. The population of the United States is increasing over time. It's very common that at any given time, the number of people working is at a record high, and the number of people not working is also at a record high. So think about that for a second. In 2010, the population of the United States was 308 million in 2010. Okay, let's just make the numbers really easy. Forget about the fact that children aren't considered in the rate. Just make it 50-50. 308 million people. So in 2010, you could have had 154 million people working and 154 million people not working. We're ignoring kids and people not counted. So in 2010, you could say breaking record number of people working and you'd be right. And at the same time, you could say breaking record number of people not working and you would be right. Then we get to 2021. We now have 330 million people in the United States. Make it 50-50. OK, we now have we could have 165 million people working. That's a record. And 165 million people not working. That's a record, too. So I hope that this shows how useless these numbers can be when the population keeps increasing in the country anyway. So don't fall for this stuff. Don't fall for this stuff. Be informed. And we'll have the graphic. If you're just listening today, we'll put the graphic up on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Emily Broad-Lieb, who is a clinical professor of law and faculty director for Harvard Law School's Food Law and Policy Clinic. It's so great having you on today, Emily. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So, I mean, let's just start with a little history. Many of us are familiar with food labels in general and also expiration dates, best buy, sell by, etc. What's the sort of history of that? When did it start? Why did it start?
Mm-hmm. So we see kind of this modern landscape of, you know, these labels on most food products really taking shape in the 70s. And at that time, it was really consumers were pushing companies and saying that they wanted to know about the freshness of their products. So, you know, if you think about where we were at that time, it was sort of starting after like post-World War II, people are getting more, you know, further away from where their food is produced, buying more things in the grocery store. And, you know, people said, if I'm not part of the farm and getting it directly from a farm, how will I know how fresh it is?
Right.
And that's when we saw a lot of activity in terms of voluntary use of these labels on the part of companies.
Now, there was also in that period of time, in like the 20 years preceding the 70s, there was a move away from most of the things at the grocery store are ingredients to really like the food product, right? Something that's manufactured and sent that. And Is that also part of why we started to see those markings that, like, with a banana, by looking at it, you can mostly tell what is the status of this banana, whereas with some of these products, it might be less clear?
Yeah, that's totally right. So, you know, and I think even today in, you know, fast forward to now where there's labels on lots of products, a lot of states require them, but it's primarily on packaged foods, because I think there's a sense that, you know, a banana, an apple, you know, a food that you can pick up and hold and that's sort of in its raw form, that people can really make their own judgments about how fresh it is and how close it is to being spoiled. And it's really packaged foods that you see these labels on, because people don't really know. They can't open it up in the store and smell it and
right.
taste it.
So there's best if used by, there's sell by, there's a straight up expiration date that sometimes is there. These things presumably mean different things, right?
One would think, actually, that's one of the biggest issues, is that consumers sort of look at them and think, these labels must be telling me different things. But in fact, you know, there's no law that really regulates what those different terms mean. There's no, you know, there's no law defining sell by as compared to use by or expires on right now. In fact, there's no federal law regulating date labels at all. So the federal government, with the very small exception of infant formula, has not required anything. And then in the states that have requirements, they use them very interchangeably. So I think that's one of the places where we got really interested, because consumers are misled. Like they think that they're, you know, that they're seeing two different labels and that they mean something different, but there's not any evidence that that's the case right
now.
Wow.
So, I mean, if I see, as the common man, if I see sell by, it suggests to me it should be sold by that date, but it's still pretty good for some period of time beyond that. Best if used by says it should be consumed by that day. But you're saying that there's not actually an infrastructure that guarantees that that's what I'm being told.
Yeah, that's totally right. And, you know, as we talk about how this can be fixed, I do think there is a piece of drawing on what consumers think that they're reading.
Yeah.
And, you know, reducing the number of labels and really drawing on like what consumers already are understanding, but just making that the case so that consumers aren't being confused about it.
With something like, when I first really started thinking about the value of some of these labels is when I saw, for example, an expiration date on salt. And, you know, when we think about salt, it's like salt's been around for millions of years. It's just sort of naturally occurring. What does it mean if salt expires? Does that have any meaning at all? Why does salt expire?
Right. I agree with you. Same vinegar. Similarly, it's
right.
already turned vinegar. Now it is vinegar. It's not going into some other thing. Bottled water, you know, and I think people are trying to like deal with this cognitive dissonance by making up some reason that the label. So I hear people say a lot, oh, the label on bottled water is like when the plastic is going to leach into the water. I mean, that is not happening. Or if it is, the date is not the date at which that happens. You know, I think you're right that there are a lot of food products that it doesn't seem very clear why a date label would be needed on them, except that consumers have just come to expect them on so many products. And, you know, I've actually talked to people who have said, when I pick something up at the store that doesn't have a date label on it, I'm not sure what to do. So, you know, again, I think in some of our early work, we thought, well, maybe we should just remove the label on foods where it's really meaningless. And I think that gets a lot of we get a lot of pushback from consumer groups on that. So we're really thinking, how can we take what we have and make it work better and make it align better and be less misleading? You know, knowing that in some cases we are where we are and we can't kind of completely overhaul the system.
If we want to apply like a corporate profit motive to this, one could imagine you could have foods that are safe for much longer than the dates say, but maybe the manufacturer is worried there could be reputational damage because it might not taste quite as good or whatever the case may be. How much of that is a factor in these labels?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that is. It's a really big factor, especially, you know, if you think about where we are right now, which is some states require dates on certain foods. There's huge variation in what foods states require labels on. And then what you can do after the label. So that leaves a lot up to the manufacturer as far as like what words to use, the science, or if there is any science behind how they're setting that date. And of course, for companies, they want you to eat their food when it's going to taste the best.
Right.
So more, even more cynical version that people say a lot is, you know, is it that they just want you to throw it away and buy more? And I don't think there's necessarily evidence of that, but there is evidence, and companies would say this outright, that, you know, they want to set a label when their product they think will taste the best. And they want to leave some wiggle room for the fact that you might not put your yogurt in the refrigerator right away. And that, you know, so they're kind of being conservative even in that date that they're setting.
When it comes to food waste, you know, we've talked for so long on this program about you got a portion of food that is just wasted on the field, so to speak. It already is sort of like by the time it would get to the supermarket, it might not look so good. So you lose some there. You lose food due to spoilage, and you lose food due to expiration dates. And a question that's often asked is, shouldn't that all be donated somewhere? And one of the reasons that's sometimes given for why it's not is, if you donate stuff to a food pantry beyond the expiration date, one, are you sending the message that people who need to go to a food pantry are deserving of expired food, right? And sort of like the PR issue with that. But also the concern of, if someone gets sick and it's beyond an expiration date, is the donor potentially legally liable? So are those, and are there other ways in which this is actually preventing dealing with an issue like hunger?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're spot on. So I would say, as far as the first point, this sort of stigma point about, is this bad food? Are we essentially saying like, we're going to give bad food to people,
right,
you know, that are accepting donated food? On that piece, what our approach has been is to say, if you really standardize the labels to have one label that's really clearly about food, the small handful of foods that actually increase in risk after the date, then everyone can be clear in their own households. And then we wouldn't donate those foods. We shouldn't be donating anything that actually is riskier after the date. And then if you have a separate standard label that's really telling people, for all of these foods, you can keep eating it as long as it smells okay, tastes okay. You know, this is just totally an estimate of freshness. Then I would say, I mean, those should be able to be sold. They should be able to be donated. People should feel free to use them. People should swap them, whatever it is. So I think, you know, to me, a law that says that they only can be donated but not sold wouldn't make sense, because it would increase that stigma. And I'll say one, you know, peer country that's done a really nice job of this is the UK, where they have use by is the standard label on food that becomes riskier after the date. Best before is the standard label on food that is labeled just for freshness. And then they've done actual campaigns with consumers. They had one earlier this year that was like, look, smell, taste, don't waste. And the whole campaign was really to let people know, if you see best before labels on it, there's no scientific way to make those accurate. And there's no risk after the date. It's really just about your preference and your palate. And then they make it very clear, those can be donated. They can be sold at a discount. You can still eat them. You can still serve them. No one's going to get sick. So I think, again, there's like a very clear roadmap for how we could improve on this, and in a way that makes it not just for, you know, for donation and giveaway, but also for everyone to save dollars.
There's a whole other kind of category of food labels. These include certified organic, all natural, no preservatives, no added sugar, whole grains only. You know, we could kind of go down the list, and different ones mean different things. Are any of these other than organic actually regulated terms in any way that have a set meaning every time they are used?
So it's a hard question, because there's truly so many of those labels.
Yeah.
Are as like what, so to speak, eco labels like organic that really relate to like the way that they're grown and produced in the environmental side. Organic is the only one. There was legislation passed around bioengineered label, which would be foods that are genetically modified, being labeled, that will also be regulated. On the health side, there are some that are regulated. For example, if you want to say that a food is healthy
or low
in sugar, there are some, but there are also a lot that aren't that heavily regulated. So on that side, it sort of depends on the label. But I should say, you know, these, a lot of those fall to the Food and Drug Administration to enforce. And like, there's thousands and thousands of products with thousands and thousands of labels. And I think most people in this space, present party included, would say that, you know, there might be labels on there that aren't actually being enforced because FDA just doesn't have the capacity to get to all of them and make sure that they're.
At one point, there was this heart healthy label, which many of us would be familiar from oats, Quaker oats. But it was basically, if I recall correctly, at least in its initial version, based on the amount of fat. And so you had very strange products, including at one point, I think it was like the equivalent of some kind of fruit roll up type candy, which I think qualified for the label based on its absence of fat. But it's not really something that we would think. I mean, it's a highly processed. It's candy, essentially.
Yeah.
And so it was like, this, what does this really mean? Right.
Right. Right. No, I think you're right. And I think this has been a critique of a lot of those labels, healthy, you know, heart healthy, low fat, whatever. There are disqualifying levels of other nutrients, but sugar, which really people weren't as worried about in the, you know, in the 80s when a lot of these labeling and early 90s. So now you have these bizarre outcomes where there's like no disqualifying level of sugar for all of these health related claims. You know, I think this is something that FDA has been supposedly working on. Hopefully we'll, you know, get around to really updating some of those labels, because I think they are really misleading for consumers. And I think today sugar is really one of the most concerning ingredients in products in terms of just the, you know, where we are as a country.
So what are on sugar labeling? Like, what are some of the issues? It seems, I mean, some that come to me off the top of my head is sometimes it will say no sugar, but it has various syrups, which are, you know, arguably not different than sugar from a health standpoint. Sometimes you will see things like sweetened with beet sugar, as if that's really different than cane sugar or regular sugar, when it's unclear there really is a difference. Right? I mean, it seems sort of like the gluten-free label on an apple, where it's like, yes, it's gluten-free, but is that really actionable and relevant in any way?
Yes, totally agree. Evaporated cane sugar. Evaporated cane syrup is one you will see, and I still see it. And I think, you know, FDA said it's not allowed. Again, they don't have the capacity to enforce all of them. So consumers pay the price of that. You know, and I think that there's both a responsibility on the part of the FDA and potentially on Congress to really beef up the resources so that those can be enforced. Evaporated cane syrup is literally sugar. It is what everyone would think of as sugar. And yet, you know, again, it will say no sugar and it will have that on a product. And yeah.
Two other specific ones that I want to ask about. So you organic is actually a regulated term with a specific meaning about the how it's grown or whatever. When it comes to all natural, what is important for people to understand about whether all natural has any meaning whatsoever?
Great question. No one can answer that question because there's no definition really from the Food and Drug Administration for all natural. So there's been a huge, huge amount of litigation, particularly in California, which has really nice laws that are very supportive towards consumers. Just a flood of litigation around a product with an all natural claim, you know, and then plaintiffs, consumers saying that they bought the product and then realized afterwards there were certain processing elements, or it was ultra processed, or it included, you know, gene edited or, you know, genetically engineered materials that people would think don't seem natural. You know, there's, I would say for now, I treat that claim as if like, I just ignore it completely. I would say like that is meaningless at the moment. And I think, again, there's a big question mark as to, if and when we will see the FDA come out with a real definition that can give consumers a little more confidence in that claim.
Last thing I want to ask about, and I know we're now getting like a couple levels removed from where we started. Homeopathic products, herbal products, some supplements, et cetera, where they say statements have not been evaluated by the FDA, et cetera. We've all seen that type of thing. What are the concerns and sort of what is in that general space that consumers should be aware of when looking at those products?
You know, now you're a couple steps from my bailiwick. they're even, you know, I've already said already that there's a lot of claims on foods that either FDA hasn't yet defined like natural, they don't really have a great definition, or where there is a very clear definition, but they just don't have the resources to enforce. Once you get into supplements, you know, herbal things, et cetera, it's even more so that way. I mean, a lot of people in the food space will call that really the Wild West in terms of the in terms of the level of both laws and enforcement. So I think it's a really difficult area. I think there's a lot of folks calling for more regulation there, you know, making sure both that there's really two concerns. One is when you buy a supplement, is what's in there actually what it says it is?
Right.
And second is, are the claims about what it can do for your health validated in any way? And I think on both ends of that, it's a really big question mark. And it's hard for the companies that are, you know, trying to do it well and trying to do a good job, because I think they will probably like more enforcement so that they, you know, they're that people will have more trust in that space.
Yeah, without a doubt. Emily Broad-Lieb is a clinical professor of law and faculty director for Harvard Law School's Food Law and Policy Clinic. Really appreciate your time today.
Great talking to you. Thanks.
Okay, I have a few sort of like short Trumpy stories to go over with you guys. These are mostly comedic elements, but they're also just sad and pathetic and more about just the sad, sad state of Trumpism and Republicans in the United States, which, by the way, they could be in a sad state and still win in 2022. And in fact, I think it's quite plausible. So first and foremost, you guys know about Donald Trump, I'm guessing. You also know about this guy, Mike Lindell. We know him as Mike Pillow. He's the CEO of MyPillow. And Mike Lindell has been one of the main conspiracy delusionists. Delusionists or delusionalists, I guess, is the question, who has been basically since the November 2020 election saying in December this thing will be overturned, by January 6th it will be overturned, by January 20th it will be overturned, it'll be March, Trump will be back in office, April, it'll be by the summer, it'll be by the end of summer. The latest, I think, is that it'll be by Thanksgiving, but clearly that is not going to happen, and maybe he's forgotten about that. This is so weird and bizarre. Apparently, Mike Pillow has recorded what they are describing as an exclusive blockbuster interview with Donald Trump. And Trump's wearing a tuxedo in the interview. I don't know why. I'm guessing there's some explanation. Maybe this was done at an event. Who really knows? And Pillow is promoting, Lindell is promoting this interview as so earth-shattering that when he plays it the week of Thanksgiving, the American people are just going to rise up and demand that Donald Trump be reinstated. And I'm going to look at just a preview of this interview. It's completely off the rails. Take a look at this.
Go back to November 4th, and we all lived this twilight zone.
Twilight.
I always say, like, there was an old saying, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one heard it, did it really fall? Well, then the media tells us there is no forest.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where it was.
I love Trump saying, yeah, as if he understands what Pillow is talking about here. Let's continue.
Back in November and December. Yeah. And
now.
You know, we were, yeah, I know. But we were all living in this twilight zone. You were living there with us. But then you had all the betrayals and attacks on you that escalated to a whole nother level. And Eric told me once that you said right before you were going down that escalator to make your famous announcement.
Can you imagine?
That you said, well, we're going to find out now who our true friends
are. That's true. Wow.
And I never forgot that he said that to me. And, you know, it was everyone out there since that time, we've all been praying for you to have strength. And my question is, what does give you the emotional strength?
Really a hard-hitting blockbuster interview, as you can imagine. So it's sort of unclear what Trump is even really doing right now. He may be, you know, there's this idea that he's preparing for some kind of big 2022 participation of sorts in the midterms. He's off Twitter. We don't really know what it is that he's doing other than publishing these bizarre statements. So just to give you an idea of what he's been up to, an example statement Trump published to his website: the Unselect Committee of Politically Ambitious Hacks continues to subpoena people wanting to know about those protesting on January 6th, the insurrection which took place during the presidential election of November 3rd. So Trump is now saying the insurrection was the election that he claims was stolen. There is so much proof, but the fake news media refuses to print it or show it in any way. Read the Arizona report. Look at Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, numerous other states. Nothing's happening there. Nothing's happening in those states. So Trump with still insisting on this stuff. And at this point, is it even to raise money? I don't know. Trump, I was going to say tweeting, but posting blog posts where he says, look at what they found in Georgia. 74 counties in Georgia are missing ballot images. Okay. Trump posting, I keep wanting to say tweeting, an article from the Daily Signal claiming that 26,000 dead people are still registered to vote in Michigan. Now, remember, guys, we've talked about this dead people voting thing. Just because someone's registered and died since being registered doesn't mean they voted in Michigan. The dead people voting thing has been widely, widely debunked. And then Trump attacking Liz Cheney with an approval rating at 19% in Wyoming. People are wise to Liz Cheney. She is a threat to free and fair elections, which are the cornerstone of our country, because she caved so easily on the crime of the century, meaning the fact that Joe Biden actually won the election. This is sad, but I think we shouldn't underestimate the reality that there is still energy behind this guy. And last week's election results, combined with whatever it is that Trump may have planned for the midterms, could very well lead to Republicans cleaning up in 2022, taking the House, taking the Senate, winning more state governorships, and having almost, Democrats would have the White House, but having almost total control of the country for at least a period of a couple of years, during which they could do a ton of damage. All right. I guess we would call it a trend at this point that we've seen for years is Donald Trump makes holidays, tragedies, and anniversaries somehow about himself or about attacking his political opponents. Donald Trump, it is Veterans Day today. It is Veterans Day today. And Donald Trump released a very short video this morning. This is his tribute to veterans on Veterans Day. Now, he sort of alludes to criticizing Biden by saying things are tough and we're going to try to fix them. He doesn't name Biden, but of course, it's all alluding to it's just so bad under Joe Biden right now. But also, like, just every aspect of this is weird. The framing is from really far away from Trump. Like, he looks almost 20 feet away from the camera. It's very strange. But the audio, they don't even have a microphone on Trump. Not even, I guess, caring enough about his message to the troops, which was partially just a criticism of the current state of affairs as Trump sees it. They didn't even put a mic on Trump. It's just whatever mic is on the camera, like down to the technical details. It's a very strange video. Let's take a listen.
This Veterans Day, I'd like to pay tribute to all of those incredible people, and you are indeed incredible people, who serve so well and so strong and right. So powerfully in the United States Armed Forces. We love you. Our nation respects you. The world respects you. And we will come back. Our country has gone through a lot. The last period of time has been very, very tough.
So this is Trump's way of criticizing Biden. I hope there's no, like, what else could he possibly mean there?
Watching what you had to watch, but our country will be back and will be back stronger than ever. Happy Veterans Day.
Yeah. Donald Trump has a very long history of making tragedies, holidays, anniversaries about himself. On 9/11. You might remember that Donald Trump called into a local TV station and said, hey, you know, now that the World Trade Center towers fell, I have the tallest building in lower Manhattan. Remember this? Take a look.
You have one of the landmark buildings down in the financial district, 40 Wall Street. Did you have any damage or did you know what's happened down there?
Well, it was an amazing phone call I made. 40 Wall Street actually was the second tallest building in downtown Manhattan. And it was actually before the World Trade Center was the tallest. And then when they built the World Trade Center, it became known as the second tallest. And now it's the tallest.
That was a nice one, right? In 2011, Donald Trump claimed that he predicted the 9/11 attacks. He didn't. In 2013, he memorialized 9/11. by sending his best wishes to the haters and losers. You might remember that one. And then, of course, many times Donald Trump claimed to be at ground zero. He has said this on 9/11 anniversaries past and just at other speeches. Here is just one example of that.
Soon after, I went down to ground zero with men who worked for me to try to help in any little way that we could. We were not alone.
So that was a lie as well. Donald Trump was not at ground zero any more than maybe he was in an office that could generally be considered to be in lower Manhattan around the time of 9/11. This should not shock any of us. This should not surprise any of us. This is what Donald Trump does, and it's pathetic and it's humiliating and embarrassing. So, okay, not going to spend a lot of time on it. That's the latest what the former president has been up to over the last couple of days. We have a voicemail number that you can call if you want to tell me anything. You know, if you have any messages for me, you can call 219-2-DAVID-P and tell me what's on your mind. Here's a really, really weird voicemail. I'm going to play it because it's just kind of funny and weird, but take a listen.
Hey, David, do you believe in birds?
You know, I do believe in birds. I've seen birds. I've seen the evidence with my own eyes. I've spoken to ornithologists who are confident that birds exist. I've had birds ravage my backyard garden, and I feel very strongly that birds exist in this world. We have a world where birds are a part of it. So I don't know. It's kind of a strange question. Once I got a question about whether I believe Africa is real, and I do. I believe Africa is real as well. Strange questions, but glad to answer them. We have a tremendous bonus show for you today. Inflation is at its highest level since 1990. Okay? We're going to keep talking about inflation, and part of that conversation will continue today. Portugal, a great country. I love Portugal. Portugal has made a law, not about drugs. We've talked about their drug policy, that bans bosses from texting employees after work. Why and why now? Part of it has to do with telework and work from home. We will discuss. And lastly, we now have seen, you know, we talk about consequences for the Trump riots from January 6th. We now have seen the longest sentence yet for any of the Trump rioters. It was given to Scott Farlam. And feds want an even stricter punishment for the guy known as the QAnon shaman. Imagine that. 2 years ago, I didn't imagine we would be talking about anybody that goes by the QAnon shaman, but we are. Feds are asking for an even longer sentence for the QAnon shaman. And we're going to talk about how these cases are going, how strict are the sentences, and more on today's bonus show. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code BETTER21 to get a discount off of our memberships. We will see you on the bonus show, and live coverage of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial also continues today on YouTube as well as on Facebook. We are 27 days from being back on Twitch, banned for 30. We'll be three down, 27 to go. So just Facebook and YouTube today for the.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you anymore.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
O-U-R-C-T, Radio 900.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Yeah, yeah, what's up? This is Total Eclipse.
Word up, Rock Raider from Executioners.
Word up, chilling,
on WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah, 88.3.
Check it out, all right?
Word up, real hip hop.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You don't even know it's the hip hop show.
Oh, we do. We do everything.
Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone.
You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Things get brighter day by day when you listen to the Big W. Life is lighter in every way when you listen to the Big W. So laugh it up and let yourself go with King Size Radio, the Big WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech.
No! It's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
Yeah, well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT-FM. Keep it locked, Rust.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
There, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automated...
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check
on
it out,
dial. Right? Peace.
Hey, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
Hey, this is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
We'll give you total control over our lives. Everyone shuts the hell up.
We're Hydra! WRCT! Pittsburgh!
You're listening to WRCT, Friends of the FCC. Good friends, good times, and eggnog.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
From New York and Glasgow, this is Democracy Now!
I prescribe healthy air as a right for all children.
I prescribe the rich nations to make the biggest cuts in emissions.
To fund climate health adaptation projects.
To invest in reversal of the negative impacts.
To build resilience.
And tackle health and social inequalities.
And stop investing in fossil fuels.
Climate change is a health emergency, and it is my ethical duty to speak about it.
We have a crisis.
As the United Nations Climate Summit enters its final day and negotiators scramble to arrive at a new agreement, the world's health workers are calling on governments to protect people from unimaginable health consequences. We'll speak with two of them in Glasgow, including Dr. Jenny Miller, head of the Global Climate and Health Alliance and the World Health Organization's Civil Society Working Group on Climate and Health. We'll also get an update on the climate activist People's Plenary at COP26 today, which was followed by a walkout. And 30 years ago today, Indonesian troops armed with U.S. M16s opened fire on thousands of unarmed East Timorese civilians, killing more than 270 of them.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
Massacre, the story of East Timor. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Climate Countdown. At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, negotiators have backed away from including a call to phase out coal as well as fossil fuel subsidies in the latest draft agreement, which was released today, the final scheduled day of the two-week summit. An earlier draft called for, quote, phasing out of coal and subsidies for fossil fuels. The new draft calls for the phase out of, quote, unabated coal power and of inefficient subsidies for fossil fuels. The draft also called for wealthy nations to double the amount of money they give to developing countries to deal with the climate crisis. But during Thursday's high-level session, Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate questioned such pledges from wealthy nations.
I have come here to tell you that we don't believe you. We don't believe that banks will suddenly put trillions of dollars on the table for climate action when rich countries have struggled since 2009 to raise $100 billion for the world's most vulnerable countries.
In a major development, the governments of Denmark and Costa Rica have launched the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, the first high-level diplomatic initiative to phase out fossil fuels. This is Costa Rican Environment Minister Andrea Meza.
It is also about acknowledging that every dollar that we invest in fossil fuel projects, it is one less dollar for renewables or for the conservation of nature.
We'll go to Glasgow to speak with people inside and outside the UN Climate Summit after headlines. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are preparing to hold a virtual summit Monday. This comes just days after the world's two largest economies announced a deal to work together to address the climate emergency. Tensions been rising between the two nuclear-armed nations for months over Taiwan and other issues. On Thursday, Xi Jinping warned against a new Cold War beginning in the region. Meanwhile, the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party has passed what's known as a historical resolution elevating Xi Jinping's status as a leader. Similar resolutions were passed for just two former Chinese leaders, Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping.